2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Elder Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we're back again with another chapter of A Study in Scarlet, this being Chapter 8. This being the new beginning of a new story in the middle of this story that we were reading, and it was so interesting. Now we have a whole new story that we're beginning. This is labeled Part 2, The Country of the Saints, and this is Chapter 1 of the story, On the Great Alkali Plain.
All right.
What an interesting setup on this. We thought our book was over, except for we didn't solve everything. And now we start like a brand new book.
Well, and that is such a huge change of scene. I'm trying to think of any other novel that I've seen make this big a shift. It's up there. So I just have to ask you guys outright, did you guys like this chapter? Why or why not?
The more I think about it, the more I liked it. There certainly is something to this break from the mystery that is intriguing for sure, because we know that we're still in the mystery. We keep looking at all of the parts of this new story and going, what the heck does this have to do with anything? This is a good break, and it's something different from what we've read from Doyle thus far. A third-person narrator, first of all. Uh-huh. This is our first encounter with that from Doyle, and he does that very well. These sweeping scenes that he describes, the cinematic quality of looking over this beautiful land and giving us these wonderful narrative descriptions, along with a really great mix of dialogue, is really interesting. Mm-hmm.
Whether I liked it or not, I'm not really sure. It really is interesting. He must have said, I need to either jump back to give a whole bunch of backstory to get to, the part we will solve our mystery back in London. Or, was this a short story that he was writing on and said, I don't know where to put it. Let's put it in here.
That brings me to an interesting question, Chip. If we had gotten this first, would you have gotten to the Sherlock Holmes part of this?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Because of the first few chapters, I mean, they were so refreshing and just, they were really, really good. In fact, the first part of this book is, I mean, I know why Sherlock Holmes was, wrapped its audience. It's the same reason Luke Skywalker wrapped the audience of the people who were watching it or Indiana Jones. There's just something, there was something special about the character, and it was immediately apparent.
What are your thoughts, Pam?
Well, I would say that in this chapter, we are really, one of the reasons you have to do this second is that now we are playing detective, right? We are thinking, why is he telling us any of this? How does this connect? And as we're reading, did you guys notice the time on this? It's 1847, uh-huh. So 40 years earlier, and it's really specific, May 4th, 1847. So it's 40 years before the publication of A Study in Scarlet. So we're trying to think, wait a minute, like, why is he telling us this? What am I supposed to get out of it? We're looking for clues. So we're reading it. It's an engaging story in itself, but it's also engaging us intellectually, cognitively, asking us to think about, like, what's the connection?
Let me say that again. You said the timing was May 4th?
May 4th, 1847. He specifically says that.
Okay. Well, it's going to be interesting because that data is actually important because yes. As we play out this chapter, we're getting an idea of, well, first of all, we're introduced to our new characters and our this traveling group who end up running into them.
We also get a change in setting. This is taking place in the great North American continent.
Utah.
We're not in Utah quite yet, are we?
No. We're working our way towards there.
We're working our way there because we get a group of travelers who are moving from Illinois to Utah. And we know historically that they make it there in July of 1847. This is the May before that.
So should I go ahead and give a little background, a little bit about this group and the Mormons who are making their pilgrimage?
Well, let's talk about the characters that we're introduced to first here.
Okay.
We have a man and a five-year-old little girl. He is kind of the stereotypical, curmudgeonly old prospector type, right?
He's carrying a five-year-old. I was thinking he was carrying a baby. And then they unwrapped her, and there was a five-year-old. You've got to be a man to carry a five-year-old like that.
And I think that when you first read the description of him, he's carrying a bundle. You don't even know it's a child. Yeah. So he's got a rifle in one hand, a bundle slung over his shoulder. He's obviously starving. He's weather-beaten, but obviously starving. And I just, even before we get into that wonderful relationship, I want to talk for just a moment, as Steve, you mentioned, these sweeping scenes and the description, the intro to this chapter, which positions us all the way in North America, and specifically in the central portion of the great North American continent, there lies an arid and repulsive desert, which for many a long year served as a barrier against the advance of civilization. From the Sierra Nevada to Nebraska, and from the Yellowstone River in the north to the Colorado upon the south, is a region of desolation and silence. And I thought Doyle did an amazing job of describing the silence, and that's not easy to do.
Yeah, there's no words for it, ironically.
Well, even flying over it, you get this. I mean, it's a different look. The terrain of the Midwest is so hardy. You can grow crops and everything. But, you know, you get to the Rockies, you get right over them. The sand, the soil just changes color. It certainly is an amazing, and I understand why people get there and they're inspired.
And I think, going back to a theme from the first part of this novel, where Watson keeps wondering, like, why is it that this single murder, or then it becomes two murders, within this great city of London, the center of civilization for a British person, why is it that that is so much more disturbing than the massive killing that accompanied the war where he saw horrible things? And here we jump from that theme into this great arid landscape. I think it's important. The terrain itself serves as a barrier against the advance of civilization. So this notion of civilization versus nature, but like nature as a really powerful force that repositions perspective. Steve, I know one of your favorite terms, right? Mm-hmm. We've got a whole different perspective on the human experience when we're in this desert space.
And a whole different storytelling mode here. I mean, we have switched completely. We have a third person narration here instead of Watson mm-hmm. telling us this story. Everything about this story has completely flipped in this.
Right. And you remember, London is an urban area, and it's really, really tight. In fact, almost all the East Coast is really, really tight. When you get out towards the West, I mean, things spread out in a way that your imagination just can't take you. It's the just scope. So big. Yes, yes, the scope yes. is just so massive.
And then, exactly right, and then as we come to this notion of this man carrying a bundle, we, in our minds, we already filled in what might be in the bundle, right? So when he opens the bundle.
When the bundle talks, the bundle right. speaks first. And then exactly. and then I was like, wait a minute, did I miss yes. something? No, that's the reveal.
There's no fairies in the story.
And then after seeing this weather-beaten man, the child was pale and wan, but her healthy arms and legs showed that she had suffered less than her companion. And you guys, she's wearing this really cute little pink dress with her little Mary Jane shoes. I mean, she's adorable. She's 5 years old and she's a complete contrast to this man. So once again, our perspective has been incorrect.
Mm-hmm. And she's healthy compared to him. He is suffering. He's not got enough water. He's dying of starvation and dehydration. And she is not as suffering as he is.
And you guys remember our show some time ago about 1 second after. Uh-huh. We talk about the situation in starvation historically. Your first wave of people who die are the elderly and the very ill. And then the second wave are the parents of young children, because they give their food to their kids. And that's just a fact. And that's exactly what has happened here.
What's that about, Pam?
Oh, pandemic? No, not apocalyptic.
we'll put that in our notes for everybody to listen to.
Pam did it. Pam put it in the notes.
You know.
Right. And put that story into my head when she introduced it to us so long ago. And now here we are.
And listen, and one of my she gave us a choice. I picked it.
Fine.
I'm the one who sent us to
blame you both
through hell.
And just yesterday, one of my friends was like, you know, your name Pam, it could be a pandemic. And I'm like, what? Don't connect this to me. Thanks for that observation. Okay.
So, yes, so we've got caring for this child. He is keeping this child healthy and relatively unaware of their situation, which is a beautiful sentiment.
Well, as many people who played the Oregon Trail, Steve, have found out, you know,
there's dysentery.
Lots of dysentery.
Well, and it's interesting, you guys, that because he has kept her so clean, so she's got her bright pink dress, it's actually the pink of the dress that draws the eye of the Mormons, of the Mormon caravan, to find them. Without that clean pink dress, they wouldn't have been found. If she had been just as weather-beaten and grizzled as him and dirty, if he hadn't kept her in the bundle, they wouldn't have been found. And so his caring for her not only keeps her alive, but is the cause of them being saved. And so when the two of them fall asleep, finally, he tries to stay awake, but he just can't at this point. She's perfectly trusting. And there's the scene I think is really beautiful. And then there's this contrast again. Quote, on the ledge of rock above this strange couple, there stood three solemn buzzards who, at the sight of the newcomers, uttered raucous screams of disappointment and flapped sullenly away. Mm-hmm. So these buzzards are waiting, right? And then when the caravan arrives, the buzzards are like, oh, we're not going to get our meal after all.
I've learned so much about buzzards from Warner Brothers cartoons.
Now, as they talk to their saviors, and we're about to talk about who they are, someone says, is she your child? To the man, who says his name is John Ferrier. I guess she is now, he cried defiantly. She's mine because I saved her. No man will take her from me. She's Lucy Ferrier from now on. And so we have gotten the idea that he is not her father, but they're the only two left of this troop of 21 people who were traveling. And and you feel like his love and protectiveness of her super strongly, I think.
So well put together. Doyle really gives us these characters. He's not dangerous. He's not hurting her. He is protecting her, and he is the father to her in every way possible in this.
And he probably knew their parents, or as any adult who would see a child in need, you're going to protect them the best you can.
The Mormons are the ones who are here walking from Illinois to their promised land, Salt Lake City, Utah, right, Chip?
Well, they didn't start in Illinois. They started on the East Coast, Steve. So are we going to take a little plunge down to Mormonism?
Yes. Let's talk about Mormonism. I'll go get a coffee.
All right. So there's a lot of places you can get your information from. I chose the Book of Mormon because they have a song in there that really outlines very quickly what happened, why they felt that they were a chosen group of people, and how they set off on this pilgrimage to ultimately find what they thought was the promised land. And this is a beat for beat of like Moses finding his promised land.
So when you want information, you go straight to the source, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the guys who gave us South Park.
Well, you don't have to. There are other places to go, but they
but
do
don't blame Canada. That's all I'm saying.
That's right. Don't blame Canada. The song starts because you all know the Bible is made of testaments old and new. But what if I told you there was a third part? And that's the Book of Mormon. There's the third book, according to the people who follow the Church of Latter-day Saints. They believe there was a third book to the Bible, and ultimately that Christ walked the Americas too. What we end up having is Joseph Smith in 1823 was told by an angel, Moroni, that there were plates that he was to dig up that were in his backyard, and that they would actually have or contain the new Book of Mormon, the new revelation of the Christian faith. Obviously, when he dug them up, he wrote them down on paper. He went to town to tell everybody about it. And as most people who proclaim to be a prophet, many of them are ridiculed. And of course, he did find some followers. They wanted to find a place where they could set up their new land. And Joseph Smith basically said, I talked directly to God. God has told us to go west. And so they started a pilgrimage with a group of people to go west. Every place that they would go, there certainly would be some kind of skirmish, some kind of challenge. On June 27th, 1844, Joseph Smith was killed in Carthage, Illinois. And if you want to know where Carthage is, if you take Chicago and you go straight west to maybe Davenport, which is right on the Mississippi, you go south following the Mississippi, about halfway between Davenport and St. Louis, you're going to run into Nauvoo, Illinois. And that's where they had set place before Joseph Smith was killed. Brigham Young was to take over at that point, and he took the Mormons through a number of other places, but they eventually arrive in Utah. And that's where they establish the Promised Land, the Church of Latter-day Saints. So if you've ever been to Salt Lake City or heard of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, anything like that, you've got your touch of Mormonism.
And there are over 16 million Mormons today.
Oh, yeah. It's a growing religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's so interesting because we've just spent this time with ultra-rational Sherlock Holmes. It's really interesting to flip from that part one to part two, the country of the saints, and to look at the different ways that religion gets represented in this section. So I think we have two sort of contrasting moments. We have the little girl, we'll just call her Lucy, although we don't know her name at the time, but we have Lucy and John talking about the fact that they very well may die out here in the desert. And the little girl is actually really excited because she's like, oh, well, if we die, that's okay. We'll see mother again. And I love the quote here. She says, I'll bet she meets us at the door of heaven with a big pitcher of water and a lot of buckwheat cakes, hot and toasted on both sides, like Bob and me was fond of, Bob being her little brother who has also died. So we get this sense of just a really clear, childlike notion, like an unquestioning notion of Christian religion here.
Mm-hmm.
But then Lucy says, say, did God make this country? Of course he did, said her companion, rather startled by this unexpected question. He made the country down in Illinois, and he made Missouri, the little girl continued. I guess somebody else made the country in these parts, and it's not nearly so well done. They forgot the water and the trees.
Slarty Bartfast wasn't working on that part of the world. He was working on the fjords. If you get that joke, then you are now my favorite person.
It's a sweet notion of what is God. And I think like Lucy's idea of like, oh, I don't think this was made by God. That's something that people say in a really cynical way, but she's saying it in a really innocent, sweet, childlike way.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. Chip pointed out that this land is so much different from the rest of the continent. And we think this is due to continental drift, the idea of that this was a part of Africa that floated over here. And maybe that's why it's such a different land. But it is so different no matter why.
It's interesting because after this little conversation about who really made this land, Lucy and John pray together. And Lucy suggests that he should say the prayer. And he says, I disremember them, he answered. I ain't said none since I was half the height of that gun. And Lucy draws him in, though. She says, no, well, here's how you kneel. Here's how you put your hands. And there's this sort of pulling back and seeing this moment of communion between this not very religious man and this unquestioningly religious child that shows this moment of total contrast in the wilderness where both of them are totally doing the right thing for completely different reasons.
Mm-hmm. And then we get the third contrast of these really religious people who are coming in that same area just miraculously, and they find these people who are struggling.
And they see the pink of that clean dress. Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to that. You know, you could read a lot of religious part to it. You know, these two people are wandering in, you know, the desert. Mm-hmm. They are lost, and then they are found. And she is a believer, and the older man is struggling with it. And of course, what do they find? They find a highly religious group, a caravan who are on a mission. They are sent by God to find the promised land. And they found these people along the way. I mean, it certainly plays very well with my understanding of religion. And certainly Doyle is playing up a little bit on that too, I think.
Yes. And the caravan is really quickly marked as religious, right? So we see this huge caravan. "Fear not for water," cried a third. "He who would draw it from the rocks will not now abandon his chosen people." "Amen, amen," responded the whole party. As a reader, we're immediately shown this is a religious group. And then one of the leaders of this group is Brother Stangerson.
Ta-da! Dun, dun, dun. So, finally, this has something to do with Sherlock Holmes.
This is our first connection. Am I right? I think this is our first connection, right?
100%. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. This is the whole time I was reading this going, what does this have to do with anything? And then Brother Stangerson shows
up. Yes. And so then Farrier asks who they are. "There seems to be a powerful lot of you." "Nigh upon 10,000, said one of the young men. "We are the persecuted children of God, the chosen of the angel Morona." "I never heard tell on him," said the wanderer. "He appears to have chosen a fair crowd of you." "Do not jest at that which is sacred," said the other sternly. So I think that's a great moment. Like, the dialogue is always so good, right? Mm-hmm. But it's this moment where we see Farrier being a little bit, you know, uncertain, I think, of how to react around these obviously very religious people, which he's not. And he gets sternly told, like, "We're saving you, buddy." I just would note that in the 1847 journey to the Great Salt Lake Valley, Brigham Young wrote in his journal that he was accompanied by 143 men, 3 women, and 2 children. So not 10,000, a much, much smaller group. And the angel Moroni is the spelling that Doyle used was completely off. Morona.
Yeah, that happens.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't there a spelling thing with Sierra Blanco also? It's Sierra Blanca. And it was just language.
Again, he's writing about an exotic land, right? So he's... Mm-hmm. He's in London writing about this exotic place that people have just barely heard of or maybe not even heard of. So he can't look up all of his spellings on Wikipedia the way we can.
Well, he just needs to invent Wikipedia.
Maybe they need to invent the computer first, but you know, I'm just throwing that out.
Details.
And then the Mormons tell Farrier that he can come with them only as a believer. And so one of the elders says, "We shall have no wolves in our fold. Better far that your bones should bleach in this wilderness than that you should prove to be that little speck of decay which in time corrupts the whole fruit. Will you come with us on these terms?" "Guess I'll come with you on any terms," said Farrier.
This is where I'm so happy to read this dialogue. Doyle is writing, again, about a foreign land that he does not know much about, but he knows about the different types of American cultures here. We've got the old prospector type. The gold rush of 1849 is right around the corner, and he's got that dialogue down cold. He says, "No, there ain't. No, there ain't nothing, dearie. You'll just need to be patient a while, and then you'll be all right. Put your head up again, me, like that, and then you'll feel bullier. And ain't easy. I think bullier might be a wrong term. I think that might be an English word, but that's
right. Yeah, that's true.
It ain't easy to talk when your lips is like leather, but I guess I'd best let you know how the cards lie. Good dialogue.
Well, you also, you know, I don't know how educated the people are. You know, we're still moving west during this time. And certainly the country is growing, and there's a lot of places, and people are looking to set up their, you know, where they're going to be.
Mm-hmm. 49ers game's coming up. There you go. That's about sports.
And history.
It's both. Then we get the stern and careful language of the Mormon, who has a completely different voice to yes. all of his thoughts. Do not jest at that which is sacred, said the other sternly. We are of those who believe in those sacred writings drawn in Egyptian letters on plates of beaten gold, which were handed unto the holy Joseph Smith at Palmyra. We have come from Nauvoo, which is not from Star Wars, in the state of Illinois, where we have founded our temple. We have come to seek a refuge from the violent man and from the godless, even though it be at the heart of the desert.
And just consider, and as you were trying to, as you were reading this, just recognize that's like a pulpit. He is a preacher. This is how he's releasing his information to you. I am an authority. You know, we are on a mission, and I'm going to speak to you just as, you know, like I'm sitting up at church. I'm the preacher.
And Doyle does that so well here.
Yeah. And a very well-educated voice, right? A sort of very clear diction.
Sure.
Especially in contrast to John Ferrier.
Mm-hmm. Old prospector versus somebody from Illinois.
And in fact, this chapter ends on that voice, where we find out again from the elder what's going to happen next. You shall remain here, he said. In a few days, you will have recovered from your fatigues. In the meantime, remember that now and forever, you are of our religion. Brigham Young has said it, and he has spoken with the voice of Joseph, which is the voice of God. End of chapter. Whew. What do you think of this, you guys?
This is a nice setup. Mm-hmm. He certainly has thrown us into an entirely different environment. We need some backstory to be able to solve our mystery.
And once again, this conversation that we've had has made my eyes even more open to how good this is. I knew it was good when I was reading it alone, but with our conversation, I see now where we're headed and why we would put this in the middle instead of this being an introduction to a mystery. This is really good writing.
And I think Stangerson is the only connection we have so far. But now, as we move forward, we're prepped, right? We are going to be, as we go into part two, chapter two, we're going to be looking for more connections with Stangerson, the secretary, 40 years later in London, and what in the world that might have to do with Enoch Drebber.
And we'll be observing and not just seeing Pam.
Well, that's always the hope, right?
That's the idea of this mystery. I hope everybody out there is enjoying this as much as we are. I hope you're getting as much out of this as we are. And keep listening. There's something's going to happen. This is going to wind up to be a great story. This is a great introduction to a second half of what was a good story to begin with. Keep listening. We are going to get into chapter 9 tomorrow. You can send us an email or a voicemail. Tell us how we're doing, how you're feeling, and follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes on all the social medias. Go to our Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these conversations that we've been having. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Elder Chip Essenblum.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where's my sandwich? We don't talk about what I want to talk about. What I want to think for. What I want to